This is day three of this December 2011 four-day session. We'll resume reading from our text from earlier, the teachings of the Chinese Zen master Lan Shi, who in Japan is known as Daikaku. His treatise on meditation, this is from a book called The Original Face, an anthology of Rinzai Zen. This is his teaching presented in a question and answer form. Question: if there is fundamentally no illusion in the nature of mind, where do illusions come from? People sometimes bring this to me as a question. Where does ego come from? Sometimes it takes that form. But here, where do illusions come from? When false thoughts arise, illusion comes along, and because of illusion, afflictions are born. When errant thoughts cease, then illusion goes, and when illusion goes away, afflictions also die out. Let's break this down. It's really very basic presentation of the whole problem of the human condition. When false thoughts arise, illusion comes along. So it originates, he asks, where do illusions come from? Originates with thoughts. To be born with a functioning brain means you're going to have thoughts, and with those thoughts comes illusion, the illusion of division, self, other, us, them, here, there, now, then. Illusion comes along, and because of illusion, afflictions are born. When errant thoughts cease, now this is the opposite, when errant thoughts cease, then illusion goes. And when illusion goes away, afflictions also die out. So this is what is, this is what Zen identifies so clearly, is this root of suffering comes from thoughts, or more strictly speaking, attachment to thoughts. The thoughts themselves don't really cause us suffering. It's our attachment to them, our attachment to notions, our attachment to concepts. The principal one being the notion of a separate self. He goes on, afflictions are things of life, seeds of birth and death. Enlightenment is the way to extinction. Extinction is one of these unfortunate translations that just keeps hanging on tenaciously to these Buddhist texts. Unfortunate because it has a negative connotation, for sure. When we say enlightenment is the way to extinction, it really means enlightenment is the way to great silence or rest. Or to use another unusual word that crops up in Buddhist texts, is the way to the great surcease, stillness. But then he wants to disabuse us of any attachment to silence. And he says, if you take peace and quiet to be bliss, all things are afflictions. But when you are enlightened, all things are enlightenment. So if we single out peace and quiet as having some ultimate value, then everything can seem to be a problem. He says, but when you're enlightened, all things are enlightenment. All things are seen as the functioning of mind, this essential mind. What we see before enlightenment as obstructions or problems, afterward can be seen entirely differently as just themselves, different manifestations of this functioning of this marvelous, mysterious, true mind. People of the world, he says, do not understand this basis of delusion and enlightenment. They suppress thoughts of birth and death and think that this is the non-birth of a single thought, and also consider this mindlessness. But these are still thoughts of birth and death, not mindlessness, not quiescence. When you try to stop thought by thought, birth and death continue. So we don't want to try to suppress thoughts. It's one of the worst mistakes we can make. And yet it's a common mistake early in one's practice. We think that there is something bad about thoughts, and we try to suppress them or fight them or expel them or drive them out. It's a big mistake. None of that is necessary. We just need to not get involved with them. Let them be. Let them be. But don't direct your attention toward them. Don't dwell in them. Question: in seeing true nature and realizing Buddhahood, what is the way? What is true nature? And how does the seer see? Can it be known by knowledge? Can it be seen by the eye? I think most of us can answer those questions. Let's see. Can it be known with a dictionary? Or do I just need a better pair of glasses? He answers, knowledge attained by studying sutras and treatises is discriminating knowledge from seeing, hearing, discerning, knowing. This practice, meaning Zazen, does not need such knowledge. This practice does not need such knowledge. If everyone could just really, really take this in, it would save us so much wasted time. This practice does not need such knowledge. Doesn't need any knowledge, this practice of Zazen. What knowledge do we need to hear? What knowledge do we need to taste, to smell, to feel, to hear, to see, to respond, Zen is the teaching of direct experience. Teaching beyond words without reliance on the sutras, to use the age-old description of the Zen school. He goes on, turning the light around to shine back, knowing and seeing fundamentally inherent nature is called the eye of wisdom. After seeing the self nature, seeing, hearing, discernment, and knowledge may then be put to use. Seeing into the self nature, coming to awakening, enables us to use these wonderful faculties, these magnificent faculties of the human mind, the discriminating mind. And he asks, questioner asks, what is turning the light around to shine back? Answer, illumining outward things, one's own light is turned back to shine on the inner self. This is Zazen he's talking about, of course. This is what we're doing, facing the wall. One's own light is turned back to shine on the inner self. The mind is bright as the light of sun and moon, immeasurable and boundless, shining on all inner and outer lands. Shining on all inner and outer lands. Well, those distinctions sort of lose meaning. But part of the effect of doing Zazen is to become aware of our inner landscape, to become aware of this, the contents of the mind and how our mind functions. It's becoming familiarized with the dispositions, the tendencies we have, the things that we keep repeating, our patterns, our mental, emotional patterns, the way we tend to react habitually. We get a good look at these things. This is the seeing the all of the underwater contours of the pond that we... the analogy we use the first day of Sesshin, the mind as a pond or a lake. When we turn this light and shine it back, we're coming to understand how we function in every way, mentally, emotionally. We can't help but see these things. This is one of the wonderful paradoxes of Zen practice, is the quieter the mind becomes, and the more empty it becomes through our sitting, the more is on display in the mind. And it's often sobering to see our afflictions on display in our sitting, to see our defilements. But boy, it's a lot better to see them than have them invisible, have them out of our awareness. The seeing is really what it's all about. When we see these things, then they don't have the same power over us. And there, and now he goes on, where the light does not reach is dark. This is called the ghost den on the Black Mountain, the abode of all ghosts. The mind phenomenon is also like this. The light of knowledge of the mind essence is infinite and boundless and illumines all things. Where the light does not reach is called the shadow world of ignorance. The skandhas and elements, the abode of all afflictions, which can harm people. The knowing mind is the light. Errant thoughts are shadows. The light illumining things is called shining, and when the mind and thoughts do not range over things but are turned toward the original nature, this is called turning the light around to shine back. It's an important phrase here. When the mind and thoughts do not range over things but are turned toward the original nature. Original nature would be the particular practice we're working on, the breath, the koan. This is called turning the light around to shine back. So, again and again, we come to the same conclusion. It's all in the awareness of things. It's all in the awareness, whether or not we're noticing what's within us and around us. That's practice. These shadows that every single one of us has, these unresolved issues, need to bring them into the light of awareness. There are words I've attributed to Jesus that really speak to this. If you bring forth what is in you, what you bring forth will save you. If you do not bring forth what is in you, what you do not bring forth will destroy you. I think this excavation of the mind is really what, more than physical pain, is what makes Zen practice so unpopular. It's never been popular, particularly, because it takes so much fortitude to look unflinchingly at what is exposed in the mind through Zazen. It is so humbling and even mortifying, the stuff that we see in doing Zazen. The physical pain is hard enough, but it's all those ways that we create emotional pain, to be able to sit through those things. Oh, it's an unusual person. Compare that to going and hearing a choir playing, or checking out other people in their best clothes, or socializing. There are no Zen mega churches. And then continuing here, this is called turning the light around to shine back. It is also called panoramic illumination. Illumining the whole of the immediate substance, it is where neither delusion nor enlightenment have ever appeared. So now this is really the full picture of it. It's not just seeing our defilements and the way that we insist on playing with thoughts. It's also seeing what is beyond all those things. Of course, we wouldn't keep doing this if we didn't see something other than our shadows and ghosts of the mind. Zazen exposes everything. It exposes what we normally call the negative, but it also exposes the what is most exalted in our nature, what is most noble about ourselves as human beings. It exposes the transcendent, it exposes the ineffable, the timelessness of things, the spaciousness of the mind. We can't have just one without the other. It's a package deal. And he says, nowadays people think of basic mind by means of errant thoughts and consider afflictions enjoyable. When will they ever escape birth and death? Well, I think he's talking about the kind of perverse enjoyment we can get from our petty jealousies and our judgments, our little hatreds of people, the ways that we can get into our negativity. There is a kind of a perverse relishing in that most of us know. But he's saying this is just a way to perpetuate our own misery. In Zen, there is a great recognition of the value of darkness, darkness of not knowing, darkness of an empty mind, a pure mind. But we also sometimes invert the metaphor, and like other religious traditions speak of light, the way Langshi here is speaking of it. There is another great Chinese Zen master, Yunmen, said to his monks, everyone has his own light, but when he tries to see it, he cannot. All is darkness. What is everyone's light? And then he himself answered, the temple storeroom, the tower gateway. It's a koan. It's in the Blue Cliff Record. But everyone has her own light. Question. Some say we should turn to the point where not a single thought is born. What about this? Lanchi. The non-production of a single thought is an expression referring to complete absence of any signs of birth, extinction, coming, or going. Birth and death come from the mind. If you don't know where thoughts come from, you cannot know the root of birth and death. Sentient beings are constantly afflicted by lustful, angry, foolish thoughts which compel them, making them turn away from their inherent nature. If the clouds of delusive thought clear, the moon of the nature of mind appears. The thoughts you hated before then become knowledge and wisdom, and you can use these thoughts to talk about reality and teach sentient beings. An ancient said, this is Zhao Zhou or Joshu, you people are used by the 24 hours. I make use of the 24 hours. question. Even if thoughts arise, they have no reality of their own. So what is wrong with them? Lanchi, even though they have no reality of their own, as soon as they arise, you go wrong. It's like things in a dream. When you awaken, you realize they were unreal. Weren't you mistaken? That which makes mistakes and produces dreams is sentient beings' false views. One day, if they hear the teaching of enlightenment and are inspired with faith, this is much better. Even so, those who do not have a really genuine aspiration for enlightenment do not realize the errors of their minds because their application of effort is not careful. Even though from time to time they suppress small thoughts, they are not aware of the big thoughts. If you do not cut off the root source, even if you have some affinity with the way, it will be impossible to escape birth and death. This is an important point here. Even though from time to time they suppress small thoughts, they are not aware of the big thoughts. Big meaning the more deeply entrenched thoughts. These thoughts are often what we call thoughts. These notions are concepts in the mind. Are often, we're not aware of them. They're so ingrained in us that we don't notice them. They're so big and comprehensive. So, for example, small thoughts would be thoughts about lunch or this person or that person or what we're going to do after sesshin or what someone said to us. These are very little discrete thoughts that can just pop up, and they're really quite harmless once we learn to not get involved with them. The more treacherous thoughts are embedded notions that have gotten their fangs in us from earliest time in our lives. The main one is the notion that I am a separate person apart from others. Or our nationality, our country, our race, our tribe, our religion is right and others are wrong. That's a big one, a really big, deeply ingrained one. Here's a really big one, is taking what is actually an opinion or a particular view of ours as the way things are. That is very subtle and very, very treacherous. But who doesn't do this? We build up views, the way we see people, groups, life, relationships. We see them a certain way and we believe them. We think, well, that's the way things are. But very often with these very deeply ingrained, subtle views, we don't recognize that these are things we've just picked up and developed into kind of a world view of things. and that they're acquired. That we're not seeing things as they are. We're seeing things through this prism that is so we're so syntonic with it, so completely one with it, that we don't even know that it's a prism we're looking through. This is the wonderful thing about going to successive sesshins, is that by and by we catch a glimpse. All of a sudden, we catch a glimpse. Oh, that's just something I picked up. That's acquired. I'm not seeing all this time. I haven't been seeing things as they are in their true nature. I've been seeing it through that filter. It's like in the theater, they have lights that you can. There are filters, colored filters that you can slide across the basic white light of a spotlight or something. You slide these, you know, different colored plates across it. It's like we're doing that all the time. We've got all these plates that are coloring how we see things, but we don't see the plates. We just see what we think is the way things are, colored as they are. It's quite sobering, really, when you consider that that we've gone through our whole lives with a colored view of things, and we're not even aware of it. Question. The sixth patriarch said, "Do not think any good or bad at all." And then the questioner continues, "To have no thoughts about good or bad surely is the essential point of sitting meditation. What are little thoughts and big thoughts?" Answer. "Do not think any good or bad at all" are words that cut directly. Not only in sitting meditation are they to be applied. If you reach this state, walking, standing, sitting, and lying down are all meditation. No need to cling to the form of sitting. A patriarch said, "Walking is also meditation. Sitting is also meditation. Speaking, silent, active or still, the body is peaceful." One of the Buddha's discourses says, "We are always in it, walking around, sitting, and lying down." And then he goes on, talking about thoughts. "Little thoughts are thoughts that suddenly arise about what is before you. Big thoughts are thoughts of things like greed, hatred, folly, false views, conceit, jealousy, name and fame, profit and support." Support. "When sitting in meditation, those whose wills are weak may keep back little thoughts, but such evil thoughts as these big ones will remain unawares in their minds." So what I was commenting on about big thoughts is one kind of them, these very subtle, almost invisible ones that are stuck to us, stuck to our eyes that we don't see. But another, he's suggesting other ways to understand big thoughts are those that cling, the thoughts that adhere to states of greed and hatred and so forth, conceit, jealousy, concern with our reputation or lack of reputation. These are very sticky thoughts indeed. And woe is he or she who runs into some of these in Sesshin when we have a storm of emotional reaction to someone or something. It can really, really pull us into very stubborn, vexatious thoughts. With these strong emotions, it's hard not to have thoughts come with them. And the thoughts usually are in terms of self and other. He goes on, giving up these big bad thoughts is called directly cutting off the root source. When you cut off the root source, afflictions become enlightenment, folly becomes wisdom, the three poisons become the three bodies of pure discipline, ignorance becomes the objective reality of great knowledge. Need we speak of little thoughts? Melding together, this non-differentiation between the afflictions and enlightenment, folly and wisdom. It's very hard to understand this apart from a real genuine awakening. Question. Someone who has long developed accomplishment at sitting meditation and whose work is pure and mature should not have any afflictions or delusion in his mind. How can those who are just beginning to cultivate practice put an end to afflictions? Well, he already laid out how the afflictions arise from thoughts. But here he's going to answer in a different way. Don't despise afflictions. Just purify your mind. An ancient said, to practice the way you must be made of iron. Lay hold of the mind and it's settled. Directly approaching unexcelled enlightenment, don't worry about any right or wrong. That's the end of his quoting. And then he explains, laying hold of the mind means discerning if the mind is in a proper state or not. Those who know their mind's errors are wise ones. Those with wisdom should not be deluded. It's an interesting phrase, laying hold of the mind. This is noticing where our mind is, whether it's on thoughts or not. It's discerning. Discerning when we might be entangled in any kind of thoughts, including these very subtle ones. Yeah, that's the real work. It's the noticing. Noticing when we're when our mind is wandering. It can be very difficult to notice it. We can spend whole chunks of time while we're sitting lost in our thoughts, and we don't know it. We don't notice it. And then eventually we notice, oh, whew, where have I been all this time? Then we have a way to get back to the practice. But until we notice where we are in the mind, we're lost. But where he says, don't despise afflictions, this is a waste of time. This is, what good does this do? Just looking at our defilements and gagging over what we see. But this is, we're so conditioned to do this. We're so used to objectifying ourselves, of looking and despising the negative parts of ourselves. And these, as these float up into our awareness during sitting, we have to be very much on guard not to fall for that trick of the ego. That's one of its many devices, is to get us to look in horror at these aspects of ourselves that we don't like. That's just playing the game, playing into the hands of the ego, is gazing at whatever, our jealousy, our anger, sexual cravings or whatever. Don't give it the satisfaction. Don't look at that stuff. You're going to see it. We see these things, sure. That's zazen. We see them. We become aware of these things, these shadows, these defilements. But seeing them, noticing them, is not the same as gawking at them and then getting disgusted with ourselves. And he says, it is like taking a lamp into a dark cave where sunlight or moonlight has never come in. The old darkness doesn't go outside, but suddenly it becomes light inside. This is a marvelous metaphor. With the light of wisdom, the darkness of ignorance and affliction don't have to go away to be gone. See what a waste of time it is to try to expel our defilements. At night the sky is dark, but when the sunlight comes out, the sky becomes daylight. The mind is also like this. Illusion is darkness. Enlightenment is light. When the light of wisdom shines, the darkness of affliction suddenly turns light. Enlightenment is not something separate. When the light of wisdom shines, or awareness, just becoming aware of these things, seeing them, they're no longer in the dark. The darkness of affliction suddenly turns light. That is the functioning of our enlightened nature. We don't have to then do anything about these things. It's already been done. We see it. All right, our time is up. We'll stop now and recite the four vows.